is in order now, and welcome everybody. We're going to go ahead and start a public hearing on Senate Bill 1084. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1084 comes to you. It was heard in the Senate Transportation Committee and was passed by the Senate on a vote of 24-6. This bill allows pedestrians to move under a roadway or proceed along a roadway with a permit from an applicable road authority. It permits those road authorities to issue permits to move onto or proceeding along roadways, and it requires the permit holders to meet signage, safety, and liability insurance requirements. This measure has a sunset date of 2012 and also an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage and signing by the governor.
Thank you, Patrick. Senator Devlin, would you like to join us?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Devlin, Senate District 19. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate this opportunity to come to you in these closing days of this session to talk to you about my support for SB 1084A. This bill allows firefighters to continue a 53-year tradition of what is commonly referred to as fill the boot. Without this bill, Oregon may become the only state in the Union where firefighters will no longer be able to use this fundraising activity to help the Muscular Dystrophy Association. This bill, as indicated by your committee administrator, comes to the Senate on a 24-6 vote. I would tell everyone here, actually a very strong bipartisan 24-6 vote. Senate Bill 1084 puts in an exemption to the improper position of a pedestrian along a roadway. This bill allows an exception for pedestrians if they meet very strict safety requirements set by the Oregon Department of Administration, both within this statute and by rule. So this actually gives ODOT the ability to set additional safety requirements if they believe additional safety requirements are necessary to protect the pedestrians involved or the general public. The original draft of this bill was flagged as having constitutional problems, and as we know here in the legislature, we commonly use that term in two different ways. This was actually constitutional problems in relationship to the Constitution, not in terms of votes. My office worked very closely with the Department of Justice, specifically I've had discussions with the Attorney General, with Mr. Shepard, and actually had some very good assistance from the state's Solicitor General. And many of you probably do know that the Solicitor General is actually basically the entry point, in a sense, for all litigation with the state. I've also had very good discussions with the Oregon Department of Transportation and Legislative Council. I have been assured that SB 1084A, as you see it now, meets constitutional muster, and if a challenge was brought forth, the Solicitor General said that she would feel very comfortable defending this bill in court. Both Legislative Counsel and the Solicitor General testified in the Senate Transportation Committee that the bill before you met constitutional standards. In fact, both of them actually came to that committee, which is a little bit unusual for the Solicitor General to appear. The exception allowed in this bill cannot constitutionally be limited to firefighters. However, it is reasonable and prudent to set very strict safety standards for parties under this exception to ensure the safety of both the pedestrians involved and the general public. Some of those standards that you will see in the bill, which I believe are extremely reasonable, in fact all of them: one, that they shall not impede traffic or cause a traffic hazard. Essentially, this means a participant cannot be standing out in the middle of the road while traffic is moving, and thus the activity normally occurs at stoplights or at stop signs. Also, they must post advance warning signs, which will give drivers warning of the upcoming activity. Also, they must wear high visibility safety apparel. This helps drivers identify who is participating in the activity. Also, they must post $1 million in liability insurance. You may have some testimony relative to this matter. I can assure you, I've been assured that the Solicitor General feels comfortable with that requirement given the safety issues involved in this bill. And as you probably know from your experience as candidates, public bodies often require use or requirement for liability coverage for use of public facilities, and obviously the public roadway is a public facility. Also, they must apply for a permit issued by the local authority under these requirements. And in addition to that, ODOT may set any additional requirements it feels are necessary to ensure the safety of those pedestrians and other motoring public and the general public in total. This bill was going to be a very small bill. In fact, I thought, taking my kind of new role, that I shouldn't really be doing a very major bill because I had a lot of things to cover. So I kind of volunteered my personal bill to do this bill. It took a long time to address both the constitutional and safety issues in this bill. But I recognized after talking to quite a number of members that there were still a few people that had some concerns. So being a strong believer in the legislative process, that's why I came forward and said we should have a sunset clause on this. I didn't make it for 2009 because there's literally very little experience before we come back into the session. I made it so that during 2011, the legislature can review this and see if it has met all the expectations that the legislature has, and the legislature can honestly make a decision at that point. I thought that was very important in order for people to be able to look at the issue and to see if some of those concerns have been addressed. I'm actually very comfortable with the legislation. As stated in my introduction, this bill allows firefighters to continue to do the Fill the Boot fundraiser. Most of you, I think, know that this activity has went on for more than 53 years. In fact, I believe, I'll give my age, I was 2 years old when this activity started. I was a lot smaller, too. Donations from drivers like you and me have raised more than $300 million during this time. That money goes towards fighting 40 neuromuscular diseases, MDA summer camps for children, and professional and public health education. Last year, in Oregon alone, $600,000 was raised in this activity through our firefighters. $1 million was put back by MDA into Oregon's economy through the Oregon Health Sciences University, Shriners, Children's Hospital, Sacred Heart Hospital, Providence Hospital, as well as to supply needed medical equipment needed to support MDA summer camps in Oregon. Members of the House, Madam Chair, this committee, Mr. Benz, who I've not had the opportunity to actually sit down with yet, I see a number of new faces on the House side. This bill has the blessing from the Department of Justice, the support of the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Muscular Dystrophy Association, your local firefighters and fire chiefs. I would ask you to allow firefighters to continue this activity and to continue to do this valuable work for Oregon's children that are struck with the unfortunate diseases that surround muscular dystrophy.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for coming today. It's always good to see you. Senator, you're talking about the money that is going to help muscular dystrophy, but that's nowhere in the bill.
No.
So if we're just talking about the bill,
yes,
let's just do that. So I have never seen this process. So tell me what I would expect.
I think you would see along a roadway, you would probably be near a traffic light or a stop sign. When traffic stopped, you would see firefighters basically come up to cars with open boots, asking people if they would be willing to donate. It would be very clear that it was a muscular dystrophy event. They're rather hard to miss because of how they dress. Money is collected. I think if you would go on and Google MDA and firefighters, I think you will get from across the United States different fire departments, different states, and to some extent it's like a competition between states, and you would see a lot of local fire departments participating in this. From the smallest,
it says nothing about fire departments.
Local firefighters.
So let's just talk about this bill. Let's say it's not firefighters. Let's say it's Friends of Spring Park.
Yes.
So Friends of Spring Park. So that's in my neighborhood.
Okay.
So they would go out and they would.
They would go out and they would meet all of the safety requirements in this bill. They would go out and get a permit from the local road authority in accordance with the standards set by the Oregon Department of Transportation, and they would be allowed to be involved in this activity.
And so they would take some container. Do you mind?
Well, they could. They could do it any way that they actually wanted to. They didn't. When
what in this bill would allow them? What would they be allowed to do?
They would be. What we are talking about. Let's just talk about the bill. Let's go straight forward to the bill.
Correct.
They would be allowed to go outside the normal placement requirements for a pedestrian along the roadway.
So they don't have to stay on the
sidewalk. They don't have to be. They would not have to be soliciting. They could be involved in some other activity. I talked about this extensively when it was on the Senate floor. I can tell you the way the bill is structured now, I will tell you that it is not structured to preclude anyone. But it is structured in such a way that I believe, given the history of how people raise money, how they conduct political activity, that I don't actually see a whole huge rush of people wanting to do this.
But if I may say, Senator,
yeah.
We make laws for the whole state,
yes.
Not for one small group. Correct?
I understand that.
So if we're doing this, any group can do this. So
yes,
any
they
group
can
go up. So I'm driving down McLaughlin Boulevard.
And any group that meets all of the safety requirements within this bill and meets all the standards can do this. Can
so
have the exception. Can have the exception to a pedestrian along a roadway.
So I stop at Oak Grove Boulevard and McLaughlin.
They cannot.
And somebody will be coming around to the driver's side asking for money.
They could. They could, yes.
That gives me pause.
If they met all the criteria that were here, and they could not impede traffic.
How could they not impede traffic if they're walking?
Because they would have to exit the roadway, particularly if it was a signalized intersection, they would have to exit the roadway.
I know Representative Gilman wants to. I had one more question. Well, go ahead. I've forgotten.
Representative Gilman.
Well, I have a question, but first, I have experienced this event. It was in White City on Highway 62. A very high-traveled roadway. And they did impede traffic. They came out when the light was red, but they didn't get back on the sidewalk by the time the light turned green. So you end up with a big traffic congestion mess. And I really have some concerns about this. We're a transportation committee. We want to get cars moving. We don't want to have congestion. And here we're allowing a bill that will have people out in the middle of the road with a basket or a boot asking for donations. It is an excellent cause that you're promoting. That's not... Oh, I don't want you to understand that Gilman doesn't like muscular dystrophy. That has nothing to do with it. I just think the mechanism for raising money is inappropriate. My question to you is, if a local jurisdiction says no to this activity, it won't happen in this bill?
Mm-hmm. If a local jurisdiction says no, and they would not be able to preclude the activity, but if you would be into a discussion with the parties that might testify after me, they could probably not preclude the activity in the first place. The other issue to think about in this is this a bill allows ODOT to set very specific standards for that conduct in terms of impeding traffic. So your parties that were out there on the roadway at that time and not exiting would be required under the standards that ODOT could set to exit the roadway. So it could actually be an improvement from your current circumstance should the bill pass. With all, Madam Chair and Representative Gilman.
I have two.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on some of the content that's already been mentioned, and I may very well be looking in the wrong place in the statute, but I noticed on page 2, line 6, It talks about the requirement to not impede traffic or create a traffic hazard. And we've heard some of the descriptions of other situations, and I've had some similar experiences. Can you tell me more about what that, how do you define what does impede traffic and what is and isn't a hazard?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, that would probably be a better question for either the firefighters themselves or the Oregon Department of Transportation, who has a representative here. Madam Chair, I'm free to answer any other questions. I do have to forewarn you that I have to get to the Rules Committee to move every remaining bill that is coming from the House.
with that acknowledgement, yeah. Representative Tomei, do you have more questions?
I do. I'll try to make them fast, Representative.
And no bills?
that's another problem. Why is this necessary if this has been happening for 53 years?
There, you will hear circumstances that in one case a particular city has a ordinance that prohibits this activity and that the firefighters are concerned about that. You also hear that there may be more than one city. But the reality is there used to be an exception in state law till only a few years ago for this same activity. Due to some other reasons and some editing of Oregon statutes, that exception was taken out. Firefighters are public safety officials. Most people don't recognize that, but firefighters are public safety officials. They feel very bound to follow the law. If the law doesn't grant them the exception, I think they feel that they're in a very difficult circumstance. Because, in a sense, if they no longer have the exception in state law, then they are in effect in violation of the law.
One last one. So why? So my group that I was saying,
yes.
Friends of Spring Park. So they decide this is a great idea. They'd like to take their baskets out to Oak Grove and McLaughlin. So $1 million bond. How much would that cost them if they were to do that one afternoon?
I think probably in the neighborhood of, depending upon the entity seeking it, or between an individual and an entity, it could vary. But my guess would be probably $300 to $500.
So
that would be a guess.
Okay, thank you. And last question, I promise. Why do you need this bond?
Well, as Madam Chair, Representative Tomei has indicated, this is activity along a roadway. It's a public facility. There is some risk involved in the activity. It's very common for us to require liability coverage for a risk involved in public facilities, particularly risk that relates to roadways and relates to transportation. So we think it's actually a very reasonable requirement. I use some examples. I mean, I do think that one person that may testify will probably differ from me, but the Solicitor General agrees with me, is that as a public official and also as a political candidate, I have rented numerous public facilities. I have paid for liability insurance both when I served alcoholic beverages and when I didn't serve alcoholic beverages, because it's quite common for public entities to require proof of liability coverage. And as many of you know, I do not actually drink any alcoholic beverages. it's quite normal for me. In fact, now these days, given the litigious nature of society, I probably would not hold an event without some type of liability coverage, even if it wasn't required.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I have to go move a toy bill. A revised toy bill.
All right. I don't see any other questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Livingston?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. We certainly echo the thoughts of the good senator from the Tualatin Valley. We appreciate this hearing today. And I would like to just start, if I may, Madam Chair, with a brief overview of kind of why this is needed, to kind of clarify additionally some of the thoughts that I think Senator Devlin did an excellent job of articulating, and then with your permission, Madam Chair, a real brief conversation from our statewide coordinator that facilitates things with MDA, and then probably and arguably the most important people in this panel, the end users of this long-standing program that has been highly successful. I'm going to start by way of helping to answer a question that Madam Vice Chair Tomei had. In 1999, we came to the legislature to make sure that we could legally continue a long-standing tradition of the Fill the Boot campaign that goes towards finding cures towards the 40 neuromuscular diseases, as well as many of the other programs that MDA offers to Oregon families. The problem that we have, if you look at the bill itself, is that without the exception to allow to be, it's called improper positioning along a roadway. And as pedestrians, once you step onto the roadway, you're actually in violation. It's a Class D traffic infraction, and you can be issued a citation for doing that. So in 1999, recognizing that we're technically violating the law, and as Senator Devlin says, certainly your firefighters like to be law-abiding citizens, we came to the legislature to have an exception to that so that we could continue a highly successful program. That piece of legislation passed with only one no vote in the House, and unanimously it was on the consent calendar. It was a bill that we worked with ODOT on at the time. That program has been in existence and codified since 99, and subsequent to that, it was a long-standing tradition. So that's the history behind it. The bottom line here is if we are to continue with this highly successful program, we need to have the exception to improper position along the roadway. And so that I hope that helps answer your question. What happened then is that, and I believe that the Solicitor General is in the audience and could probably brief you on the constitutional issues and the reasons why the bill was having to be repealed on that, had to do with a court case. That happened actually in the 2005 session, unbeknownst to us, and we believed, and at the time in working with DOJ, we thought we could continue with our program. Unbeknownst to us, in 2007, we did start to discover, and it was after the 2007 session, we actually discovered that technically, by the letter of law, we were in violation of improper positioning when they repealed that. And so that is why we then discovered that, boy, we already have started to experience in 2007 where this has had an impact on our ability to raise funds for Muscular Dystrophy Association. And so that's a little bit of the genesis behind the bill. I think Senator Devlin has talked about this, and while one of the reasons why we need to have it broad-based gets us back into that constitutional issue, no longer could we have in statutes that the firefighters have an exception for that, because it runs afoul of, I think it's Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, but I'm going to leave that to the attorneys in the room. But that's the conundrum that we're facing. And so what I'd like to really focus on here are two thoughts, and then if I may, Madam Chair, turn it over to Kevin and to our great family to my right, is two schools of thoughts here. One, this has been a hugely and highly successful program. And while I recognize that, you know, not everybody that travels Oregon roadways are necessarily happy all the time when they see some of these events. But I think overwhelmingly, by the support that we receive in doing this, and by the fact that particularly now that we're in a recession. I know a lot of economists will say that we're not, but as a John Q. citizen in Oregon, and somebody that, you know, sees many people's lives impacted every day, bottom line is I truly believe that not only here in Oregon, but even more so around the nation, we're in a recession. And so where I'm going with this is that I think we need to step back in this conversation and recognize that while the state, there's many needs in the state, clearly I think this session you've recognized that you as the legislative body and through the Ways and Means process are not going to be able to provide some of the well-meaning programs for some of our most vulnerable in Oregon, whether it's seniors, whether it's people that have physical challenges and those kind of things. And so in my strong belief, particularly now, we need to look to groups like the firefighters and to corporate America and these partnerships that have been in place that help fill the gaps to find these needs for these families that are needing that. And I just want to reemphasize that over $1 million of economic stimulus went into Oregon last year because of our ability to have this fill the boot campaign that we've done for years. Not only are they doing research at Oregon Shriners Research Hospital, the Providence Medical Center in Medford, Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, and the fact of the matter is they are finding some cures for some of these neuromuscular diseases. In addition, the summer camps that we provide, and I'd like to just explain what that is a little bit, this gives kids that are inflicted with neuromuscular diseases an opportunity to go to a week-long camp where, once again, firefighters on their off-duty days volunteer their own time and effort to do one-on-one activities with kids that, you know, unfortunately, some of these kids have never had the opportunity to get in a swimming pool. But with the one-on-one and with the training that firefighters have, we're able to see these kids for sometimes first time ever get into a swimming pool, have normal activities that, you know, we would all love our kids to be able to have. Unfortunately, you know, diseases are inflicted upon some of us. And so the bottom line is while I understand your angst with this bill, we have done this successfully for 53 years, and if it wasn't for a court decision, the reality of it is that this probably wouldn't even be in front of you. And so the question that I have, and I think this bill has been vetted very hard in the Senate, and that's why they worked tirelessly and why there was 3 hearings on it, there were sidebars, there was groups that came together. We know that this bill is not perfect. But we also know that life's not perfect in the fact that we still have diseases that many of our young kids are stricken with, such as muscular dystrophy diseases, neuromuscular diseases. And so we would ask you, to give us this opportunity to prove to you that with the safeguards that are in the bill, we do and we believe that this does address the safety needs of Oregonians to keep this activity safe. And in fact, through the process in the Senate, this bill is much more stringent than what was passed in 1999. And I think it's a testament in some respect that, if you may, Madam Vice Chair, by the fact that you didn't even recognize this activity, I think that goes to the fact that this has clearly been a safe activity, one that while some people may be frustrated with the imposition and the, you know, it may back traffic up a little bit, but all I would suggest to you is think about those families that every day they're backed up a little bit by the fact that they're inflicted with these neuromuscular diseases. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but if it would please the chair, if briefly we could allow these people to talk, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Bob, thanks for your testimony. I do have a question. So tell me again the court order that was resulted in this bill.
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair Tomei, I don't know specifically the exact court case. It's just my understanding in conversations that because of a court decision that dealt with constitutional issues in 2005 session, they needed to repeal that authority that gave us the exception to improper positioning along the roadway that the legislature gave to us in 1999. So they had to repeal those portions to make sure that it was in line with a court decision that came down, similar to what happens a lot of times through the legislative process.
Will we hear, or maybe it doesn't
we
make
can,
any difference.
Yeah,
okay. But you do realize there's nowhere in the bill that mentions firefighters. There's nowhere in the bill that mentions muscular dystrophy. You do realize this covers anybody in the state who wants to do this, right?
Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair Tomei, that's correct. And the reason that it's not written that way is that you would then have a constitutional problem with that. And so this bill addresses those concerns that you have. Not that we want to prohibit activities, but what you have to do is you have to make sure activities are safe. And so really the question that you have to ask yourself is that are there enough safeguards put in place? And I, in my opinion, as somebody that has years of experience as a firefighter that deals with emergencies on roadways, with the requirements of this bill, this activity can continue to be done safely. And so then the question is that will you see a whole bunch of other groups want to do this? And in my opinion, you won't. As an example, I don't think you're going to get your local Cub Scouts to say, hey, that's a great opportunity. Let's go do that. Let's fill out the paperwork. Let's do that. The risk benefit is simply not there. What I suggest to you, though, for a long-standing practice that the firefighters have and the unique experience that we have dealing with emergencies on roadways, our members are well vetted with the provisions that are in the current bill to continue with this.
I understand that. I'm not concerned about you. I'm concerned about the Friends of Spring Park or the Friends of something, A Avenue, who are coming on the roadways. I'm sure that you're absolutely right about firefighters being very much aware of the risks and the safety issues. I'm not sure that some child who is going to be campaigning for some other issue is not going to be coming around on the road. And they have every right to do this. All they need to do is follow the rules here and have a bond for $1 million, which would, as Senator Devlin mentioned, might cost $300. Well, they might make $1,000 that day. I just have some concern. It says nothing about firefighters. This is, opens it up to anybody in the state. So, and I have one more. You said that it may back up traffic a bit, but it seems to me that on the second page, line 6, it says does not impede traffic or create a traffic hazard, and yet we heard from the good representative from Southern Oregon said indeed that was his experience. Do you want to respond to that?
I may. Given an opportunity here, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, just as with any activity that's going on, certainly, especially when you start posting warning signs and doing those kind of activities, no different than a one lane being closed or construction ahead. Anytime you start putting out warning signs, you're automatically going to have people slow down and traffic's going to back up. Now, when you actually put people out there on a red light and they're, you know, people are rolling down their windows to give spare change, clearly we are getting off the roadways when the lights turn green, you are going to have some traffic backup, just similar to you have traffic backup when you have a red light or when you have a stop sign, it backs up traffic. And so I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but I think that's kind of because of the safety requirements and the slower traffic, you are going to slow your traffic down. But then again, that's that safety element that's involved in the bill in order to realize that this activity can continue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. For the record, Kevin Gray. I'm an IFF firefighter here with the Oregon State Firefighters Council and liaison between the Oregon State Firefighters Council, the firefighters, and MDA. I'd just like to say for the last 7 years I've been doing Fill the Boots in Springfield, for the last 4 being the liaison throughout Oregon. Roseburg, any other city or firefighter agency that's looking to do Fill the Boot, I usually, you know, give a helping hand with my experience at boot camps once a year. Part of the safety is that we go through all the coordinators and we make sure that they all understand exactly, you know, in the roadway when it's red, out of the roadway when it's green. We do a lot of training that way. And again, firefighters already have some training as, you know, a part of our job. The other thing about this that I want to just briefly touch on is, you know, I see both sides of it. I see the fill the boots and how much good that does when it comes right down to the camps, to the kids, to the individuals who are receiving all the donations that we give to MDA. And I'll introduce the family here in just a second. I've even had ODOT come by and spot check us during fill the boot and stop in and say, hey, by the way, looks good, keep it going, you guys are getting out when it's green, That's what we want to see. Thank you very much. I've followed the provisions very similar to this through ODOT, the regulatory agency that we used at the time for the last multiple years and still continue to up to this day. We've had no problems, and the safety of my members, the safety of the firefighters throughout Oregon, I make sure it is followed because it is my guys, in my opinion, that are going to be out in the streets. One thing that I have thought about this for many, many years is, yes, what could we do instead of being out in the streets? Do we stay on the sidewalks? From what I have seen and the experience I've had, if you have firefighters on the sidewalks, the public is so, they look forward to this event every year. I hear that when I'm out in the public as a firefighter, you know, whenever they see me with MDA. There's people that look forward to this event to give money to the Muscular Dystrophy Association, give money to the firefighters. I've seen individuals, when we're walking back on the green, actually wanting to give money, and we tell them, go around again, catch a red light. If we're just on the sidewalks, on a red, on a green, all the time, I'm afraid of what those individuals are going to want to do. They're going to want to cut across two lanes of traffic, three lanes of traffic to get over to the sidewalk so they can give money. Is that more of a traffic problem than on a red, firefighters being out in the street? I don't think I can answer that right now. I don't have a crystal ball, but I can use a little bit of common sense and think about it a little bit and go, it's probably not very good. So that's my experience with that. Once again with camp, I've been through the liaison up at the Portland camp in Welch's, Oregon, as well as the Central Oregon camp, which is actually just out of Springfield. And I've been a counselor with Mason and a bunch of other individuals with muscular dystrophy. With that, I appreciate your consideration. I appreciate your time. And if you have any questions, please feel free. With that, Rebecca Carter and Mason Carter, they're actually a part of the MDA family, but a part of the firefighter family because they're one of us now.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Carter for the record, and this is Mason. And Mason is diagnosed with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. He recently just received his wheelchair with MDA. Is actually paying $2,000 of. I have actually been to quite a few Fill the Boots. We've done the Albany Fill the Boot, which was downtown by the, if any of you guys are familiar with Albany, right by the funeral home, where they just go out in the middle of the traffic when the light is red. Just this last year, during Jamboree weekend, we actually did a Fill the Boot at Lebanon at Airport and Highway 20, which traffic was very, very busy, if you guys can imagine. Jamboree weekend, there's thousands of people that drive through Lebanon. It was a perfect weekend to do it. Traffic was backed up with motorhomes, boats, everybody heading to Sweet Home and go to Foster. It was a great thing. And I do want to, I take my son, and my older son is in the back. We go to the Fill the Boots. The firefighters are the only ones allowed in the roads. They wear their turnouts. They normally have, it was really hot out. They had their helmets on. They have their turnouts on. They have red shirts. Some of them actually had on the vest. It is very, very safe activity. The light turns red. They're all immediately back on the sidewalk. We didn't have any problems. Yes, they were probably impeding traffic, but traffic was backed up from light to light, but most of it was Jamboree traffic.
Wow.
And the big stars driving through waving. So, and I've been this summer when we went to Estes Park, Colorado, we actually drove through Estes Park, and they were actually standing in the middle of the road with cones with a Fill the Boot, so they were actually on the driver's side. I don't know what Colorado law is, but they actually did not get out of the street. Estes Park is not a huge area, and that it is the gateway to go to the Rocky Mountains. So I've seen both aspects where they do stand in the road all the time, and then when they actually get out of the road, it's a very safe. Everything is signed. And I think just like your questions, and if somebody else wants to do it, as long as they have the signage, and you need to have signage way down the road, as long as people driving in their cars understand that they are going to get stopped or the person in front of them is going to stop, because they want to donate money to the park or to the firefighters or whoever wants to do this event that does what ODOT says, I don't think there's going to be a problem. And yes, people do get irritated and people do drive around the block. We had a H2 Hummer drive around three times just to give money, all three times. And we do have people in there, like Kevin was saying, if you are just basically on the sidewalk, you have people that are on the inside lane trying to wave you money in the passenger seat, and they want you to run out in the middle of traffic. And we have to tell them, no, we can't. And we've told them, because my son, my four-year-old, has standed on the side of the road. People have drove up to the site and gave him money because he's standing on the side of the road holding the boot. He is not allowed in the street. But they pull over and they give him money. And we are trying to keep them, the traffic going, because the light was green at the time. So they are very safe. They watch the kids, make sure if there is kids there, that they're on the sides. A lot of times they put up a tent. For example, at Lebanon, this year we're going to actually put a tent in Forest Parking Lot, which is a shopping cart, sorry, across the street from Safeway. And we have the ladder truck up. There's a sign that's on the ladder truck that's hanging out into the roadway. It says, MDA, fill the boot. There's signs. It's a very safe activity, and I think as long as everybody else follows the rules, that anybody can do this that wants to do this, as long as they follow ODOT's and they follow the law. So, any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was struck by your description of the experience in Colorado where folks, it sounds like, stand in the road.
They do. They do.
I'm interested in hearing how we in Oregon decided that it's better to go back and forth. It sounds, on the face of it, like that might be better.
Well,
to stay in the road.
To me, it depends. I mean, I'm sorry, you probably wanted to answer that, Kevin.
To me,
at Estes Park, it's a very small two-lane road coming into Estes Park. I don't know if anybody's been to Estes Park, Colorado. It's like going into Sisters. It's very quaint town, we were only going 5 miles an hour anyway because it was Labor Day weekend. So, to me, I mean, that's a perfect weekend. And the traffic, it's not like traffic's going to get up to 35 miles an hour when the light turns green. So, to me, if it's a smaller, slower road, I don't think that would be a problem. But that is totally up to you guys, and that's up to them. So, sorry, Kevin.
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, I think the best way to answer that question is that we've tried to and we appreciate the hard work that ODOT has put into this bill, and we've had many meetings even in 1999, and we've had meetings dating back to this fall. We've worked with ODOT, and so some of the requirements that they've suggested on there are on their recommendation, and so I think that's the reason why we would feel comfortable wanting to get out of the street is because a lot of these guidelines are... The bottom line is on streets and on roadways, ODOT are the experts, and so we've wanted to partner with them and work hard with them, and so we want them to be comfortable so we can be comfortable as well.
Follow up. Thank you. I also was struck by your description, Kevin, of the training you do with folks and with ODOT and so on. Do you expect that some of the other groups, the Friends of Spring Park and others, would have that sort of infrastructure in place? And are you prepared to work with them and help them learn from your experiences as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Reed, I can't speak for the groups, obviously. My recommendation would be yes. And, you know, they do need to have a plan, you know, and that's what firefighters do. We always have a plan, strategy, tactics, all those things. How is it going to work the best? Through the firefighters and the coordinators, we always do, you know, get together once a year, wherever it may be, and talk through, you know, some of the problems we've had. And we educate the new coordinators in that. Now, if it is, you know, Friends of Island Park or wherever, whoever it may be, I would definitely recommend that they do look through the ODOT regulations. That's something that I've followed up very close with. And if for any reason I get a phone call, yeah, I'll share my experiences. You bet. Why not? It's a part of safety, and it's important. Otherwise, my guys are going to have to go out and, you know, maybe pick them up, which I don't really want to do either.
I appreciate that. Last comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, I don't know which one of the two of you asked this of, but this is the first hearing I've been through on this issue. But I know the $1 million in liability insurance would apply, I suppose. I'm not sure to whom, because it seems to me that the firefighter would be hurt worse than the car in the event someone was run over. So how did you guys discuss holding the drivers harmless in case one of your men doesn't get out of the road, the light changes, the runners are squashed? Who's liable? And what does this bill do? Do you anticipate this is going to be addressed in rulemaking or what?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, the issue with respect to the $1 million liability policy is to emulate several other states that allow for this activity to take place. As far as specifically to indemnify the driver and those kind of things, certainly I don't know the law well enough. But the intent behind the $1 million liability is because of, you know, let's not kid anyone, there is some risk of being out in the roadway, and so there are, you know, anytime cars are moving and people are getting on and off the street, there is that. And so part of the $1 million liability is to assure that if something were to go bad, that you at least have a policy in place to start addressing some of those needs.
Sure.
Yes.
I think the idea is that there's $1 million there in case someone swerves to avoid hitting the firefighter and smashes into someone else. The theory being that whatever your activity was caused that event to occur. I think that must have been what people were thinking. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't do anything for protecting the driver against the exposure to liability for having hit the firefighter who failed to get out of the road in time. And so that would be the indemnity issue that maybe you were referring to. But just for purposes of having something in the record that can help the rulemaking activity that will follow, is it your thought that the firefighters should be limited in their rights against the drivers that are unfortunate enough to run over them? Is that what you're thinking?
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, what we're thinking is that having a policy in place to at least, no different than what Senator Devlin has, at least make sure that people are aware that there's, from a safety standpoint, you have to have additional safeguards on potential high-risk event. I guess to answer your question, maybe I'm not understanding it very well, is that clearly, you know, negligence on one side or the other would come into play, and that's the reason, once again, why you have to get a permit, why there's warning signs. No different than, you know, I guess I would say someone that's working on a construction site that post signs in that. I guess my question back to me is that who's liable in that situation? Clearly, you need to follow the law. That's the reason why there's the safety requirements built into this bill, and then the additional safeguard to make sure that people that are going to do these events are not taking it lightly to cover those safety elements.
One last follow-up. Yeah, this builds on Representative Tomei's remark, which was the policy, of course, is to move people down the road as opposed to allow money-raising activities on the road. And so what we're debating here is who should bear the risk of this money-making activity. That's what we're debating. And, of course, it should be those that are trying to raise the money. And by the way, I'm all in favor of the money being raised. But I'm also in favor of having roads that are roads. And so this is but for the value of the purpose for which you're raising the money, I'd be totally opposed to this. And I'm not yet sure where I'm going to come down on it, because I'm unclear on how exactly we're going to protect the continued use of the roads for roads. But that's not a good answer to the question you posed to me.
I'm sorry. It's the best I can come up with.
Thank you. We're going to have to kind of move this along, but thank you guys for coming today. I'm guessing probably we'll try to finish the testimony, but we'll probably carry this over till tomorrow to make a decision. Andrea Meyer.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I feel that the ACLU plays two roles when we're down in this building. And for the most part, you've heard me in front of this committee pretty infrequently. But when I come in, I'm usually objecting to a policy decision, what you're actually passing, because of a position and a policy of the ACLU. But there's another role we play, which is to alert you to concerns we have about the constitutionality of measures. The underlying policy is not a civil liberties issue. What people do in the roadways is not particularly a civil liberties issue. It may be an issue, as I think you've all discussed, that has safety issues. So I want to be clear, that's our role today. That's my role. I'm not here to comment on the much good that is done by folks who are advocating and raising funds. With that said, we do oppose this bill as currently drafted because we think it raises a significant vulnerability to a constitutional challenge. Now, I did testify on the other side originally that the bill was facially unconstitutional.
I'm not doing that today, but I am raising the red flag that it is significantly vulnerable. And let me explain. There is an issue around Article 1, Section 8, and regardless of what occurs in other states and what other laws in other states pass muster under their constitution, ours is different. Article 1, Section 8 is different, our free expression provision. The courts have interpreted it in a broader protection for our right to exercise free speech, and so I would never want us to compare it because we have unique case law. You heard a bit about the fact that there was a previous law repealed in 2005. Quick history, if I may. Previous statute ORS 814.090 was held unconstitutional in an ACLU case called Springfield v. Aquazap, and that was in 1996. Now, once the court has ruled that something is unconstitutional, local governments and state government are on notice. And if they still enforce an unconstitutional law, they're vulnerable to attorney's fees and other sanctions. In 1999, as you heard, I believe it was Representative Randy Leonard who came and amended and added on a provision for firefighters to the law that had been held unconstitutional. Now, it's probably impolitic for me to say about my boss, but I started lobbying in 99, but in the middle of session. We missed that bill. We would have certainly alerted you that the underlying law you're amending is unconstitutional, and carving out exceptions for firefighters is unconstitutional. So I know that in 2005 you repealed the law because local governments have been using it and they were getting in trouble. But I want to make clear that the firefighter provision was also unconstitutional, and it would be our position it wasn't simply an accident that it went away. It would not have withstood constitutional muster if you had left that part in there. Where we believe this is still unconstitutional, as I've is particularly the $1 million liability. Now, what we are talking about is protected free speech activities, one of our most important rights. And when the courts look at that, they look at, is it facially unconstitutional? Here it's not anymore. Anyone can do it. But what are the bare requirements one has to meet to be able to exercise that free speech? And as you add more and more, as you make it more restrictive as to who, it becomes increasingly vulnerable. And the $1 million liability may not be a problem for an organization, particularly if the speech they want to do is to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars. They pay some money for the liability insurance, but they still make a lot of money. But that's not the only folks who are going to be and have the right to access this. Now, for the record, I spoke to our insurance carrier. We're a little bit more an organization that doesn't get the easy, quick funding because our speech sometimes is apparently more alarming. So we have a higher amount we would have to pay. And for a one-day use, it would cost us $500. Now, we may be out there saying vote no on ballot measure XYZ. We're not raising funds. It would cost us $500. But more importantly, we need to move beyond the organizations who may already have insurance and talk about the individuals. Let's look at the types of folks who will have the right and should have access to this. It's the individual asking for money. It's the guy with the squeegee wanting to clean your window. It's the business down the street wanting you to come shop there, and they have a sign up. It's the petition gatherer wanting you to quickly sign their petition. It's the legislator saying, vote for me. It's the individual asking for bus fare. Those folks, many of those folks, can never obtain a $1 million liability insurance policy. And as applied, that would make it quite vulnerable, because if you have a huge swath of people who cannot access it, you have a problem. And you've heard testimony about this is really to address a concern for the firefighters. And they believe that they can pay the $1 million liability fund protection. But we don't pass laws just for one entity. And we don't put up barriers and restrictions that only one group or some groups can satisfy when individuals have to be able to satisfy it. I want to compare, because I testified before the Portland City Council on their street and sidewalk permit process. Because I asked this committee to compare the type of use there and the burdens put there. And I did testify that if they added any additional burdens, we thought it raised constitutional issues. And they did maintain it. In fact, they changed it to a way that we thought was great and we could live with. to use a small group to use a sidewalk, and they define that as less than 200 people. So we're not even talking about one person, less than 200. They're on the sidewalk, they must obey the traffic regulations, and there's no city support required. No permit needed. No fee needed. No insurance or indemnity needed. Large sidewalk, at least 200 people, same criteria. There might be actually minimal city support, so some of our funds go to that. Yes, you need a permit. No fee, no insurance. Okay, let's talk about the street use, because this is really comparable to street use. There, they're talking about at least 75 people in the street. The police will likely be needed, and possibly maintenance under the rules, because there may be interference with traffic. Do they need a permit? Yes. Do they pay a fee? No. Are they required to get insurance and indemnity? No. But you're looking at passing a state law that for one person to be on the street, not 75, who still don't have to have insurance, one person, they would be required to get a $1 million insurance protection. In addition, the City of Portland's ordinance and rules have a waiver for those who cannot afford it. This law does not have that. In addition, the City of Portland has an appeal process. This does not have it. There's some other specific concerns about the legislation. We've talked about this road authority, and on Section 5, page 3, it talks about a road authority may issue a permit if the following conditions are met: proof of liability, that the group will meet the safety requirements of ODOT, and once they've been issued a permit, they shall provide a copy to the local jurisdiction. Nothing prohibits the local road authority from adding additional criteria. Again, the road authority may issue a permit if these criteria are met. Now, the reason I raise that is because once you do that, and I think there was even testimony from the LC last time as to different folks having different rules, different local jurisdictions, there's too much discretion. They can have a different rule in Portland and a different rule in Tigard. And when we're talking about free speech or different criteria, that can't happen. So I'm concerned about the may issue. It means they may not, and they might start using the discretion impermissibly, and that's a constitutional concern. I know that Senator Devlin mentioned that you might hear from the proponents that there's been some problems with some ordinances, and I know that didn't come up, but I want to raise it for you. Medford passed an ordinance, and Roseburg, I think we filed the challenge to Roseburg a number of weeks ago. When I first testified on this bill, I was not in a position to publicly announce, but I am now, that we've given notice to Medford that we believe that local ordinance restricting the use is unconstitutional. So maybe we'll help the firefighters, because if that's the area where they're concerned, we will be challenging that, and we hope that they back down from that. A few other things. I mean, you've heard a lot of conversation about, and it's great that the firefighters are well-trained, and they know the safety of the road, and in fact, that's part of the thing. But this is not a firefighter bill. If it's a firefighter bill, you got a problem. You've got a constitutional vulnerability right off the top, because this is an everyone bill. And everyone isn't going to have that training. And individuals using squeegees may or may not get off the road the right way. And they may be bugging you and your constituents. And the person selling the newspaper, who may be getting 20 cents, cannot pay a $1,000, $500 insurance, but they're going to make a claim that that prohibits them from engaging in the same activity that these folks are engaged in. So, I also note that, and for those of you who drive I-5 or any of these things, what's most frustrating is when the traffic slows down because there's an accident on the other side of the road. Traffic tends to slow down. I think I want to conclude. I guess if I can check a moment to see if there's anything else I just wanted to mention. I think I've covered most of everything I want to say. I really would urge you, ACLU gets no pleasure in saying something's constitutional and then having to challenge it. I'd rather you pass something that's constitutional. We have a pretty good track record. I don't think it's 100%, but we have a pretty good track record against the state of Oregon when we challenge Article 1, Section 8 free speech provisions. Now, different lawyers can agree, and I don't disagree with the Solicitor General that they could defend this. Please note that I'm not saying they couldn't defend it. They absolutely can. But I think it's extremely vulnerable. I think you're opening up the door to a legal challenge that will mean that the firefighters will not be able to do this activity, you know, and we'll be back here, and it will cost the state a lot of money. I'd urge you to remove the $1 million liability or not proceed, because I do think there's legitimate concerns about you are opening the roadways for everyone. The squeegee guy, the newspaper, the candidate, anyone engaged in any kind of lawful speech activity. So I urge you not to move this bill as in its current form. Thank you.
Questions?
Silence.
Yes. We're going to try to wrap this up real quick, but I'm going to ask Mary Williams and Robin, I don't know if anyone has any questions of you, but if you want to come up just in case, so we can move on to our next subject.
I'm Mary Williams from the Department of Justice. I know that time is short for you, so I'm happy to answer any questions you have. We have looked at the bill. We worked in terms of modifying the original version of this to deal with some problems that were raised that needed to be addressed. And I think that there is not a facial constitutional problem for this bill. Obviously, as it's applied, as decisions are made, as local authorities may impose additional requirements on permits, you could run into some challenges that would have to be addressed in those individual circumstances. But what we've evaluated is how is the bill overall, and always knowing that whenever you're dealing with speech issues and Article 1, Section 8 issues, you may run into litigation around that you have to work to defend the decisions that you make. But I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thanks. I'll try to be brief. Thank you for coming today. So, Ms. Williams, we're hearing that this, of course, doesn't apply just to firefighters, and constitutionally it can't just apply to firefighters. So the previous speaker mentioned that even people who are running for office, so if I'm running for office and I want to go out and give people my literature, and I can apply to the city of Milwaukee where I live to be able to do that, and I wear my little vest, and I can do that, right?
Madam Chair and Vice Chair, yes, if you met the criteria that are set out in the bill and also any additional safety criteria that ODOT enacts through rulemaking, and the difficulty is you cannot write an exception that is narrowly focused on the firefighters. That may be the impetus for looking at this, but in order to draft it in a way that's constitutional, you can't focus on the reason the person is there, you can't focus on group membership, and you certainly can't focus on the content of any speech. And so it has to be drafted in a way that does not narrowly target any of those, but instead is anyone who meets the criteria that are focused on the concerns that the state does have, which is the safety concerns that ODOT has and that the state has for individuals on the roadway.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions for the department if we're ready to move on, if that's okay. Robin, I wonder if you could give us a general sense of how you might go about the rulemaking that's mentioned, and the three sort of specific things that occurred to me, not a comprehensive list, but I mentioned earlier on page 2, line 6, there's it says create a traffic hazard, so I'm general interested in how that might be defined. Also, if you've contemplated in your consideration of making rules, if there might be different types of roads that would be acceptable and some that wouldn't be, and would there be a way to require some level of training as a condition to getting a permit?
Thank you. For the record, I'm Robin Freeman from the Oregon Department of Transportation. Chair Beyer, Representative Reed, those are all very good questions. I don't know how much I can tell you about how we would go about the rulemaking process. It would be very open. We would work with the cities and the counties and the firefighters. But again, it would be very much about safety. So that would be And I think we have some fairly broad parameters when we look at safety, and I think that we, it would be about making sure the person was very visible. It would be, additional requirements might be weather conditions, whether or not other activities were underway. If there was already a parade scheduled, or, I'm a Duck fan, I go to Autzen Stadium. If there is a game on Labor Day weekend and there was a lot of traffic expected, we may limit the areas that they would be allowed to participate in if they came to us for a permit on that type of day. And I'm sorry, could you help me? What was your first question on page 2?
There's a mention
impeding traffic.
That and what a hazard is, how that's, if that's defined somewhere else in law or in your rules.
I probably am not very good help. I could guess a hazard would be if there's already, the Terwilliger curbs come to mind. If there's already a hazardous area in a roadway, that we would probably acknowledge that this is already a hazardous area where there's a high level of traffic fatalities, or there's been accidents, and those are the types of things that I am speculating, I'll be very honest, that we would look at. But this does concern us, so we would look at those things because we want people to be safe. We want the traveling public to be safe. We want the firefighters and any other group that participated in this bill to be safe also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative DeLay,
can
we have
one?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Ms. Freeman, did you take a position on this bill? Did the department take a position on this bill one way or the other previously at other hearings?
Chair Byer, Representative Vance, we have no position on this bill, but we have worked with the firefighters, with DOJ, with the governor's office, a little bit with the cities and counties, at least in conversations with them, and with legislative council, and we feel comfortable with the language in the bill. I can say that we are given enough latitude to work on the rules and the permit system with these folks.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had is one of safety. So what you're saying is you think that you can get to safety from the language that's in this bill. You can allow this money-making activity on roads and keep the folks safe.
Chair Byer, Representative Bands, that will be our goal, to go on the record and say that we ensure, I'd love to go on the record and say that we ensure that this will never be a problem. What gives us some comfort is that there is a sunset, so we're going to be able to monitor this activity. And I am not personally aware in the past when this program was underway that there was a safety issue. I have not looked into that, I will say that, and we could do that, but we want people to be safe. That's what I can say on the record today.
One last follow-up. And of course, the priority is safety first and then actually non-impeding traffic second. So let's just talk about that for a minute. We're making a choice here of allowing money-making activities to prime efficiency of traffic movement, or you're going to try to make the rulemaking take care of that?
Chair Byer, Representative Benz, I think that safety is always first with ODOT. It's one of our main goals, and we do not want to impede traffic. I will say that. We would never place safety over impeding traffic, but we're going to work towards both of those. It's our goal. It's our hope.
Thank you.
Representative Tillman.
Thank you so much. Ms. Williams, I have one more question. We heard from a previous speaker that the $1 million liability, whatever that's required, would imply that there's probably only one group that's going to be able to afford that. Do you have any comments about that?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Tomei, we don't have information, I think, enough to know exactly what that is going to do for groups trying to comply with this. And I think that's another thing in terms of having the sunset provision in this may allow us to have some additional information about whether groups can get that kind of liability coverage. We heard from Senator Devlin about what cost he had anticipated given his experience. We know that other states do impose liability requirements similar to this and that groups are able to comply with that. But I think we simply don't have enough information to know how restrictive that may be. And it's true that if it becomes so restrictive that only a very, very narrow segment of the population is able to actually make use of this provision, that would raise some concerns in an as-applied challenge. But I think at this point we don't know how restrictive is that requirement. balanced against the fact that you have individuals and cars in the same space, and so there are some legitimate liability concerns, and that's what that is inserted to address.
Thank you. One last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So could you talk about ODOT's requirement of $1 million liability? As I recall, in a private conversation, you said that was a requirement that ODOT had.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, we feel very comfortable with the $1 million liability policy, and I think that the good Representative Benz talked about that earlier, and that is in case, in avoiding a firefighter, if someone would not get out in time for the green light, if a motorist or a pedestrian or a bicyclist or whoever was involved to avoid a firefighter perhaps caused an accident or was in an accident, that we would want to be sure that, you know, there was some protection for the public, and that's what was behind that that consideration that we asked for and that has been put in this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your sticking around, and I am going to go ahead and have to figure out the carry.
Yes, Madam Chair, the committee, if you would, the committee is allowed to announce it will carry this measure over to tomorrow's agenda. I will call upstairs and have them post a revision of tomorrow's agenda, even though it's within the deadline. We have an agenda item already on tomorrow's agenda that says possible carryover, so we would just roll that bill right
okay.
over there.
So we will carry over till tomorrow.
Will we be hearing from cities and counties about if they have any interest in this?
Well, I know they're here, but they could. If you could either check with them afterwards or... if you don't get to them, we can call them up.
Thank you.
And so I'm going to carry this public hearing over until tomorrow. And thank everybody for coming. And we're going to try to squeeze in our informational session, and it could go until 5 again. And I apologize to everybody. My timing, sense of timing has not been good.
So you didn't know.
I'm going to go back upstairs and keep negotiating. I'm working on a bill.
Okay. So as long as you can stay, we appreciate it. Okay. Mr. Garrett, let's get started. And if you have someone you want to bring with you, or are you just going to introduce everything?
I'm going to introduce, and I'll step back, sit in the front row, and we'll have three folks come to share quick, and we'll be as crisp as you want, Madam Chair. Fair enough. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and it's a pleasure for me to bring three gentlemen who are going to share with you some of the innovative, creative, and I think leading-edge activities we have throughout the department. I would offer to you that eyes from across the nation, if not internationally, are looking at some of the things the state of Oregon and the Oregon Department of Transportation are doing. I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the governor and you for the statutory authority for allowing this department to engage in kind of the non-traditional type activities that we truly believe are needed to address some of the challenges we face in here in the 21st century. There are three players I want to bring forth, and they're going to share three distinct stories about some of the activities we have going on. The first is Mr. Damon Fornum. He's our sustainability program manager. He's going to tell you about ODOT's leadership and the adoption of our state agency sustainability plan that goes back to 2004. He will also outline the work we're doing and have done and future work as we weave sustainability principles within the organization. Following Mr. Fordham comes Jim Witte. I know you've heard from Mr. Witte several different times, and just to remind you, Jim leads the Office of Innovative Partnership and Alternative Funding. The road user fee, the public-private partnerships are significant efforts that Jim has commanded. And today, Jim's going to speak to a couple of initiatives that speak to engaging solar power, solar highways, or alternative fueling corridors, something innovative to this approach. Following Mr. Witte comes Tom Lauer. Mr. Lauer is the manager of our Office of Major Project Delivery. His folks are responsible for delivering the $1.3 billion state bridge program. Woven into his program
is a concept known as context-sensitive and sustainable solutions. Nice little bumper sticker of CS cubed. Mr. Lauer will explain this concept of how we weave it into the delivery model and how we're doing so far in engaging that concept, as well as how we are doing in terms of delivering the overall State Bridge program. I'm very proud of what these gentlemen are going to share with you today. I'm proud of ODOT to the extent that I think we are leading the nation in some of these activities. So it's a pleasure for me to introduce these gentlemen with Mr. Fordham leading and to showcase what we're doing at the Oregon Department of Transportation. So with that, I'll stand down. If you're comfortable with that, we'll bring Damon up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So again, I'm Damon Fordham. I'm the Sustainability Program Manager for ODOT. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about ODOT's sustainability program. We're trying to take steps at ODOT to plan for the challenges of the future and to conduct our business in a way that supports Oregonians' quality of life. We're taking this concept of sustainability seriously, and we're creating a sustainability program because it makes sense for us as a state agency and for the people that we serve. I think we have a duty as a state agency to be efficient, to continually innovate, to provide excellent customer service, and to conserve resources, and these are some of the underlying tenets of sustainability. So my testimony today, I'll cover three areas. First of all, I'll provide a background to the sustainability program and describe what I do as a sustainability manager a little bit. I'll provide some examples of specific actions we're taking within our internal operations in ODOT. And then I'll talk a little bit about how we're thinking sustainability applies to our mission, the sort of external piece of how it relates to the transportation system. So on that first area, the sustainability program, we're really trying to institutionalize the concepts of sustainability through the development of an integrated and strategic program. And it's an agency-wide program and attempts to provide some central oversight and coordination and to be a resource to staff who are looking to incorporate sustainability into their work. It's a cross-divisional program, and it addresses both the sort of internal piece of our impact as an organization, the fuel we use, the energy we use, the waste we create, but also it attempts to incorporate sustainability into the transportation system that we develop and manage. So we sort of formalized our sustainability activities in March 2004, when our original sustainability plan was adopted subsequent to the passage of Executive Order 0303, as did about 20 other state agencies. But we'd really been undertaking sustainability activities for a long time in the department. We just may not have put that formal name to what we were doing, whether it was things that we did as part of the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the creation of our routine road maintenance guide for best management practices for water quality and habitat, fish passage program, our green light pre-clearance program for trucks, just a few of the things that we did before we had the sort of formalized program and before that sustainability word came into existence. So as the sustainability program manager, I administer our sustainability efforts. It's a position that was created in May 2005, and I'm located in ODOT's director's office. I have a sustainability council that helps me provide oversight to the program. It's an internal group of nine mid to senior level managers, appointed by the director and representing a variety of functional areas and geographic locations around the state. So they provide the high level direction to the program, they approve and monitor sustainability work items, and they recommend policy and practice changes to the director. So the sustainability program really sort of takes a high-level perspective. It focuses on more of the high-level issues, developing programmatic goals for the agency for sustainability in different areas, policy analysis, interagency coordination, rather than actually implementing specific initiatives within the department. Now, obviously, we are implementing specific initiatives, but those are typically managed and implemented by the functional area experts, the staff within those areas. So I would work with those staff closely on those projects, but then really try to maintain sort of a high-level perspective, identifying barriers to making change, integrating work across functions, and really thinking about the sort of long-term strategic challenges that the department faces. So that's a little bit of background on the sustainability program in general. I wanted to just highlight now a couple of more specific, tangible things we're doing within our internal operations as an agency. So we're a major fleet fuel user. Obviously, we have a large fleet, and we're a major building energy user, but we're trying to take steps to reduce those impacts to meet some of the governor's goals and legislative goals for biofuel use and energy conservation. So on our, on the fleet side of things, we have about 5,500 vehicles and pieces of equipment, 2,500 of which are motorized, and they have a value of about $390 million. We have the highest transportation fuel use of within state government in Oregon. In 2006, we used 2.3 million gallons of diesel fuels and 1.2 million gallons of gasoline. But we're trying to reduce the impact of those, that fuel use, although obviously there's a necessity in using that to undertake operations. In fiscal year 2007, 13% of the diesel fuels that we used as an agency were B20, a B20 biodiesel blend, so a 20% biodiesel blend. In October 2007, that had increased to 22% for the month. And then now, as we're entering into the winter months, that's dropping down a little bit. But we are on track to meet the governor's goal of 25% use by July of 2010. So in addition to our biofuels use, our maintenance crews and our fleet managers are also taking steps to try to conserve the amount of fuel that we use. An example of this is switching out truck and message board light bulbs to light-emitting diodes, LEDs. And what they do is they reduce the need to idle trucks and they save fuel. You can often power those message boards, once they've been retrofitted with LEDs, with solar photovoltaic panels. It's a clean energy source, and that means that you don't have to idle a truck or run a diesel generator. And obviously there's financial savings to that in terms of the fuel that is used, but also in terms of public health for workers around the equipment and for the general public. Some other initiatives, we're testing some heat recovery technology on some of our heavy equipment, which means that we don't have to idle trucks to keep the cab warm in the winter. The heat from the truck gets generated back around into the cab and warms the cab of the truck. We're also leading an effort to convert some of the state's motor pool, the older Prius hybrids, to a plug-in electric hybrid fleet. We're working with DAS and with the Oregon Department of Energy to try and procure some conversion kits and to convert some of these older Priuses to plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, which means there's an enhanced battery, and you can then plug the vehicle into the grid, and you can get up to 100 miles per gallon on in those vehicles. So those are some of the fleet efforts. On the facility side, we own about 1,100 built facilities, about 43 facilities over 10,000 square feet. And in those facilities, we use 45 million kilowatt hours of electricity in 2006, and that was at a cost of about $4.3 million. But again, we're trying to take steps to reduce that impact and work towards the governor's goals for energy conservation in our facilities, which is a 20% reduction in consumption levels below 2000 levels by 2010. So our facility managers have been switching out inefficient lights, purchasing ENERGY STAR equipment when replacements of equipment are needed, and working to make our buildings more efficient. Again, tangible financial savings for moderate investments. So any new facilities we do design and build are built to lead leadership in energy and environmental design, silver standards at a minimum, that's per the state standards. But we do go beyond that when it makes sense. And an example of that is our new headquarters transportation building here in Salem, the design of which we've just got proposals back on the request for proposals for the design portion, and we're targeting that building for a LEED Gold because we undertook a cost-benefit study. And what that study showed was when you take a life cycle perspective into account and look at the whole life of the investment, we would save about $90 million over the next 20 years by investing in more money, a little more money up front in a high-performance green building where our staff would be productive, would be happy, healthy, and that would be energy efficient building. And so there's a real advantage in having that life cycle perspective of the cost and benefits of the building over its life. And then lastly, on the facility side of things, some of our most prominent facilities around the state are our maintenance yards. We're trying to manage those facilities with an eye to the environment. We have an EMS, an environmental management system, in place, which provides best management practices for the storage, handling, use, and disposal of materials typically found at the ODOT maintenance compounds and equipment shops. So that program has been implemented statewide since 2005, It's resulting in yards consistently falling within the lowest threshold determined by DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, for waste generators. Results in fewer regulations and oversight requirements, again reducing costs for the agency. Reusing a lot of different materials: wood, tires, steel, antifreeze, used oil, batteries, solvents, and light bulbs. And really the message from that program is that it's just considered a great success by all levels of staff, all levels of maintenance staff, resulting in cleaner yards, neater yards, and safer yards that are better environments for our folks to work in. And the last sort of internal effort I wanted to talk about was our conservation and alternative resource teams that we're starting. We call them CARTs. And again, it's sort of a small effort. It's a grassroots effort of small teams in some of our major facilities working on conservation efforts such as recycling, energy saving, and commuting options. And these groups are comprised of enthusiastic employees that are authorized to spend just a few hours a month on these types of activities. Some examples are creating stores within offices where used office supplies can be left by one employee and picked up by another for reuse so that things don't have to be bought new. Clearly labeling recycling areas so that people know what they can recycle and how. Setting up educational events and fairs to share alternative commuting practices. So just small steps, but I think they're very significant in that they help to shape the culture of the organization and they build on into bigger successes, and folks can incorporate those lessons into their broader work. So we currently have two of these teams, one at the DMV headquarters and one at the transportation building, and we're working to roll those out to other offices in the future. So then, moving on to the third item I wanted to cover today, which is our the mission-related piece, or the external piece of incorporating sustainability into the transportation system and how we think about that. And that's really just as important as the internal piece of thinking about it in our internal operations. And I often try to go back to the underlying need that the system serves when we think about sustainability for the transportation system, why we have a transportation system and what it serves. And really, I think, arguably, it exists to help Oregonians access goods, services, activities, and destinations so that they can take care of their day-to-day needs. So whether you're someone that wants to take your kids to school, to go buy a pint of milk, if you're a business owner operating a business, or someone going to visit a doctor, we have needs and we use the transportation system as a means to accomplish those needs. And I think when we think about the system, we should recognize that the future may look very different from how things look today. I think the need to reduce greenhouse gases and also constraints in global oil supplies, those two issues are going to be significant issues for how people and goods move around, obviously in the state, but worldwide. I think also, as well as the transportation system impacting the climate in terms of greenhouse gases that are generated, we're also going to be seeing more and more impact on the transportation system from climatic changes. And obviously we've seen a number of things over the last couple of years that have impacted the system, whether it's the recent December storms or the washouts on Highway 35. Whether or not and how directly related to climate change they might be is debatable, but it's those kind of events that have a significant impact, and I think we'll see more of those as we see these climatic changes take place. Another challenge is the growing and aging population in the state. That's a bigger population, and a different demographic of population will have different needs, which we will need to address. And then obviously funding challenges will continue to be an issue, since our primary revenue as a state agency is based on gas tax, and obviously we know that is losing purchasing power year after year. So I think all of those challenges combined mean that we need comprehensive, integrated, and innovative transportation solutions which continue to allow Oregonians to meet their needs. Now, we do have the OTP, the Oregon Transportation Plan, which does discuss those challenges, and it lays out the policy foundation for how to address them. There's seven goals in the OTP, and one is focused exclusively on sustainability. Underneath that broad goal, there are policy statements which relate to environmental responsibility, to energy issues, and to the creation of communities. And then specific strategies listed under each of those policies. So we're building on that policy foundation, and we're implementing specific initiatives in the transportation system. And my colleague Jim Whitty will follow my testimony to discuss a number of projects that his office, the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding, is implementing. One of those is the Solar Highway Initiative, and one is the Alternative Fuels Corridor. I think the bottom line is that ODOT's efforts in these regards are really leading the nation. I think we can be proud as a state of what we're trying to create here in working towards those comprehensive, integrated, innovative transportation solutions for the future. So just to summarize, I touched on three things today. I gave a little bit of a background and description of the sustainability program, how we manage and oversee it. Gave a few examples of some of the specific tangible things we're doing in our internal operations as an agency. And then I talked a little bit about what sustainability means to the transportation system. So again, we're taking this program seriously. We're working to spread sustainability programs, sustainability principles throughout the agency. It's not easy. It takes time. But we know that these efforts have a great value to the citizens of the state, and proud of what we've done so far, but obviously recognize that this is a journey and something that we'll be undertaking for many years to come. So thank you for your attention and your interest in the initiatives, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead,
Jim. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Whitty. I've been before you before. I manage the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding, and all but maybe one of you have heard about it. Basically, what we do there is we use try to leverage ODOT's assets and attracting private investment into various projects. I think that's a way to describe it. And we've applied this kind of a theory to a couple of energy-related initiatives. We call them the Solar Highway, first in the nation attempt. Here, and the second one is also a first-in-the-nation attempt called the Alternative Fuels Corridors. Let me describe the Solar Highway Initiative. ODOT proposes to secure private investment, installation, and operation of photovoltaic solar panels on ODOT facilities, particularly along the right-of-way, to provide the department's electricity requirements with green energy. Now, there will be three new applications. We all know about the rooftops, and that's been done for quite a while. We're looking to do ground mounts in the right-of-way, along sound walls, and occasionally with a bridge application. Now, if you look on the second page, you can see some photographs. The ground mounts on the left and the sound walls on the right. This program will not only do these three applications, but also further energize application of the rooftop mounts. Now, we estimate that the solar applications along 120 miles of ODOT's 16,000 miles of right-of-way will be sufficient to provide the 45 million kilowatt hours annually needed to light Oregon's highways and support the transportation system. So here's how it's going to work. We hope private partners will be procured to finance, install, maintain, and operate the solar highway projects along the right-of-way at their own cost. Now, the department's obligation would be twofold. One, to provide access to the land and facilities, and then secondly, to purchase the power generated in this manner at rates no higher than what we currently pay for energy generated from traditional sources. Now, through a request for information, we learned that such a private market exists. And we've had a lot of interest. Some 50 companies are interested in this, participating in this. Tomorrow, we will present this opportunity to the Oregon Transportation Commission for a factual finding that will allow us to proceed with a procurement of these firms through the Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program. Now, if successful, this solar highway initiative will provide a renewable, clean power alternative for Oregon's roads and highways at no additional cost to taxpayers and likely a reduced cost over time.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I just... This is phenomenal. I'm so impressed. This is the best thing I've heard all day.
Well, thank you. I would like to give credit to one of my staff members for coming up with this idea. Allison Hamilton came up. She was watching a television documentary about green power in Europe, where they have applied solar panels in this manner in Germany and a few other countries, and said, well, we should do it here through our program. So here we are.
Well, making kudos to you and to the departments. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
So that's one first-in-the-nation thing we're hoping to work with and make happen in Oregon. The second one is the Alternative Fuels Corridor Initiative. It's become apparent since I started working on road user fees a while back that now people are actually driving fuel-efficient vehicles in large numbers. My prediction of a few years ago has occurred. But they tend to be the hybrid electric vehicle or an occasional all gasoline but still highly fuel efficient. And for other alternative fuels and vehicles to come to market, there has to be three things that occur. We've got to have production of the alternative fuel. We have to have an alternative fuel vehicle readily available to consumers. We've got the supply and the demand, and then you've got to have the thing in between that connects them. You've got to have a distribution network. And typically, the limiting factor, we have lots of alternative fuels out there right now. I mean, you've got natural gas, biodiesel is being used, ethanol, ammonia, hydrogen is coming. But without a distribution network, it doesn't really matter if you've got a vehicle that can use it and you've got production, you can't get the distribution going in between. Distribution is essentially a private sector responsibility, and that's where it should be maintained. But what we're hoping to do with the Alternative Fuels Corridor is give a boost to this private sector development of a network by incubating demand through predictable availability of alternative fuels at convenient and easy-to-find locations. And what I'm talking about is basically taking a corridor along, say, Interstate 5, and every 40 miles have an ODOT, existing ODOT property, an alternative fueling station developed. And we are working on this with Washington, California, closer with Washington right now, to try to get a corridor that we have alternative fuel stations all the way up and down Interstate 5. That's the corridor. And then what would happen is the private sector partner would be required to put in the distribution of a particular fuel once Department of Energy has determined that production has hit critical mass for that fuel. Now, these alternative fuel stations would also provide solar-powered charging stations for plug-in electric and electrification for existing truck parking at rest areas, because right now a lot of them come on and just idle there, and the emissions go up in the air and we lose fuel, but you know, nothing really good is happening with that. And the department intends to create a backbone of supply with this corridor so that the private sector then can feel comfortable building the remaining part of the network. So it's just a backbone. To finance this, what we would do is have the private partners engage in a limited amount of commercial activity on ODOT, the ODOT property related to the alternative fueling stations. Now, some of this could happen at rest areas because they're the most well-accessed and known properties along Interstate 5. But if this was to work, the alternative fuel corridor could be built at no additional cost to taxpayers. Now, I must say there are hurdles, greater hurdles for developing this than the solar highway. We may have state law changes required, and we're looking into that now. It's not certain, but we want to be sure we're on firm ground with it. And then also an exception for certain federal restrictions as well. We may not need a law change, but we may have to get an administrative finding indicating that we can do this. But it's something that we're trying to give a jump start to basically alternative fuel distribution network, the thing in between. That seems to be holding up adoption of alternative fuels across the country. Hasn't been done before, but we're getting interest from, actually strong cooperative interest from Washington, state of Washington. And they have an innovative partnerships program, too, up there. And then also in California. Something, an aside, we're proud of our efforts in this area on fuels efficiency. There's a little note there on the last page of my testimony about a $3 million loan given to a nonprofit organization called Cascade Sierra Solutions to fund heavy-duty truck efficiency and idle reduction programs. I won't take credit for this. It's not in my program, but I thought you should know about it. Basically, the loan funds purchase of making fuel-saving equipment, such as auxiliary power units, available through a lease to small truck operators. And that and some other elements are basically giving small truck operators the opportunity to save fuel and thereby save expenditure of greenhouse gases as well. So we're proud of that. I guess that's enough for now. And if you have any questions.
Any questions?
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Gilman.
Jim, I want to congratulate you on the excellent presentation you gave in Washington, D.C. and Wyoming on our per mile experiments. It's really great to go to a conference and have someone from Oregon there as a specialist, and we appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
I guess Mr. Tom Lauer is up next.
Yeah. We'll have to be out of here by 5, so.
Well,
you're going to lynch me soon anyway.
And I have the longest, printed testimony. So if you bear with me, as I will go to the highlights of that, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to appear.
Yeah.
So I will go to the highlights, you will find all my material in my written testimony. I'm here today specifically about...
By yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Thomas Lauer. I'm with the Oregon Department of Transportation as the Major Projects Branch Manager, specifically in charge of managing the OTIA 3 bridge program statewide. In 2003, the legislature enacted the OTIA 3 package of funding, and specifically $1.3 billion for replacement of bridges on the state highway system. This was part of a $3 billion Transportation Investment Act and is geared to replacing and repairing 365 bridges. This investment is probably the largest investment in our system since the interstate program in the 50s and 60s. As I mentioned, there are 365 bridges, and as of December of 2007, 73 are complete, an additional 83 under construction and remaining under design. All will be complete by the end of 2013. Today I'm here to talk more extensively about the context-sensitive solutions, or CSQ as it's referred to. It's been a driving force in the success of our program in attaining its 5 bridge programs that we have. That is to stimulate Oregon's economy, employ efficient and cost-effective delivery methods, maintain freight mobility, keep traffic moving, build projects sensitive to communities and landscapes, and capitalize on funding opportunities. CSQ is the framework that allows us to keep our agency staff, consultant engineers and architects, and our contractors in alignment with those goals. CSQ grows out of a program from the Federal Highway Administration and AASHTO, State Transportation Highway Transportation Officials, an integrated safety, environmental, historic, community, and preservation concern. They called it context-sensitive solutions, or CSS. We've taken it a step further to include sustainability. And that in part came out of an opportunity when in 2000 then-Governor Kitzhaber issued an executive order on sustainability directing all state agencies to take into account the needs of future generations in planning and resources. The bridge program took that on as an opportunity and included those goals within our program to form CSS. We stage construction to maintain mobility for travelers and truckers and to benefit small communities along the alternative routes that we impact. ODAS collaborated with the Oregon Manufacturer Housing Association, Oregon Truckers Association to keep freight moving, and work with the American Automobile Association to link it to our TripCheck, our award-winning travel website. In collaboration with resource agency, ODOT consolidated multiple environmental permits into a single set of performance standards that save both time and money in the design and delivery of our projects. And while they still allow us to ensure the stewardship of our highways and the natural areas that are surrounding them. The program is sustaining more than 2,500 jobs annually and also ensures that minority and women workers are recruited into the construction force.
So let me take a couple minutes to go through the five goals and how we apply them to CSQ. First was to stimulate Oregon's economy. And I'm happy to report we're doing that. If we had not executed this program, we weight limits on our stage bridges would have been common, and that would have reduced the loads the trucks and could have carried over them. And the impact of that was estimated at the beginning of this program to be about $123 billion in lost production and 88,000 jobs over 25 years. That cost has been avoided by this program. Now our program is expected to sustain an average of 2,500 jobs per year, as I mentioned, but during our peak construction years of 2007 to 2010, we're expecting your target to go up to 3,700 jobs annually. The economic benefits are far-reaching beyond just the construction industry to local businesses and the communities that we're working, and to support industries to those construction contractors across the state. We're also making opportunities to emerging small businesses and those owned by women and minorities. With the increased levels of construction, we're partnering with the industry and increase the number of workers and apprenticeships and training opportunities within the workforces of the contractors. And we're helping to attempt a more skilled workforce pool for the future of the state. Our efforts in the workforce development was recognized by the American Public Works Association with its Diversity Exemplary Practices Awards in 2007. Our second goal was to employ efficient and cost-effective delivery practice, and I report we are doing just that. We have bundled our projects on a CARD approach, and by bundled I mean we have taken groups of bridges as they logically are in an area of the state together or along a specific CARD and put them into packages, what we call bundles. This allows us to bid them and design them more efficiently as a group, for contractors to work on them more effectively as a group, and also allows us to manage mobility quite effectively across the state. We've also introduced innovative contracting methods. Routinely, the agency uses what's called design, bid, build, where we design a project, take it to bid, and then go construct it. And we are using that within this program. But we've also moved into and made substantial use of design build. And that's where we allow a contractor and designer to partner up at the very beginning of a project, submit a proposal and a bid to us on that price. And then when they are awarded that contract, to move forward on both the design and construction simultaneously in some times, but also to move forward with jointly found economic advantages and opportunities within their contract. This also often allows for accelerated delivery, which has been a value to the program, while allowing us to control costs. One example was the reuse of detour bridges at multiple sites rather than building temporary structures that we might normally do. We're also moving to try another alternative method of delivery called Construction Manager General Contractor, or GMGC, on the Willamette River Bridge, just outside Eugene. It's the largest bridge in the program, valued at about $150 million. But in this method, we will be hiring directly to the state, the contractor, and the designer simultaneously. But in a project that's containing a greater number of unknowns than our normal projects, this allows the state to control the cost of the project, manage the risks, but still allow for innovation and acceleration. We've also benefited by being able to negotiate and work with our permitting agencies to comply with 14 separate environmental statutes through 11 different federal and state regulatory agencies for program-wide performance standards and streamline the time-consuming environmental processes. At the end of 2007, we have 124 structures already permanent, 100 more in process. This has been a great aid to our agency and to our partner resource agency, while allowing us all to effectively and efficiently do our work without any staff growth, while also maintaining our environmental and highway stewardship responsibilities. The success of the program, we've been awarded ASHTO's Best Program Award for Environmental Excellence in 2005 and 2004. We received the Federal Highway Administrator's Environmental Excellence Award and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Environmental Stewardship Excellence Award for the use of this program. It's been a huge success for us. We've been able to maintain freight mobility and keep traffic moving. That was our third goal. Under this goal, we were working to minimize traffic hassles to help keep drivers on their trips and on time, keep travelers informed about bridge construction delays and where they exist, and keep freight moving. Part of our success in this is around the bundling that I talked about earlier. this allows us to stage the corridors across the state so that we can complete one corridor, move freight over to that corridor, and then begin work on the next. It has also allowed us to manage the overlap of each bundle and the timing of it so that they're not conflicting with each other. We've worked in a great deal of detail with the Oregon Trucker Association, the American Automobile Association, Oregon Manufacturing Association, the state police, and the local municipalities to keep traffic moving and to coordinate those corridors. Our success in doing this and the group of stakeholders and teamwork around that has earned us AASHTO's 2007 Team Excellence Award for our mobility program. Building projects sensitive to your communities and landscapes. This is one of the keys to the success of the program to date. We've done an unprecedented amount of public involvement at the community level. Every phase of a bridge or repair or replacement, ODOT has engaged Oregonians. ODOT is proactively engaging them to weigh in on topics ranging from how the bridge will look to how traffic restrictions should be structured. Stakeholders, businesses, communities, special interest groups, they're all part of who we talk to. We've talked to many Oregonians through dozens of public meetings and state events throughout the state. Long before any heavy equipment moves on a project, we're looking for the best ways to connect with the communities, explain our project, and get their input. On all projects, from the beginning of design, we are putting our information together through news releases, newsletters, and small public gatherings. We broadcast announcements when construction is about to begin and use news releases, letters, flyers, door hangers, ads, and continue these efforts through to keep people informed on what we're doing. The intensive public involvement in the design phase was perhaps most critical in the Columbia Gorge Scenic Area. 26 of the bridges are slated for that corridor, valued at over $160 million. Each bridge offers a vantage point through the corridor of scenic significance. We've worked extensively with the gorge, with community members, stakeholders, representatives from state and federal agencies to gather input, secure buy-in on design elements ranging from abutments to railings, landscapes, and wildlife crossings. The resulting corridor strategy provides a framework for design guidelines to help ODOT manage and improve the interstate, move us quickly through the permitting process in the gorge scenic area, and has earned us through that partnership the American Council of Engineering Companies' recent recognition of ODOT and our partners with the 2007 Excellent National Recognition Award for the Design Guidelines. Other elements of our public outreach that have been important. After a meeting with local businesses in the Cottage Grove area, ODOT reduced bridge replacement schedule from 12 months to 9. Along Highway 20 near the coast, construction went into impact to the family's home, and after learning that the homeowner was an emergency medical responder, we changed our construction program that will allow for nighttime construction and limit it strictly to the daytime. In Ashland Middle School last summer, students, we brought them in and had a fair with them building bridges out of gumdrops, toothpicks, crackers, and other assorted materials, and followed that immediately with a stakeholder meeting about their local bridge that we were working on. It was a great opportunity to bring together the students and their parents and at the middle school. The result was an increased community awareness and involvement, a fun and memorable learning experience for over 100 students. In addition to the extensive public involvement, we also developed a set of performance standards to encourage environmental stewardship and sensitivity. Recycling has been the most visible aspect of the bridge program and efforts in this area. Recently, in the course of replacing two bridges on I-5 near Wilsonville and replacing 22 lane miles of highway in that area with more than 130,000 tons of pavement that was recycled to help keep it out of landfills. On another project, we replaced, in the course fork Willamette River bridges, 88 beams that made up a detour bridge are no longer needed. Those beams, at least 80 of them, were reused in other temporary detours within the program, and we expect to attempt to use them again. A key ODOT goal is to leverage bridge funds. This is our goal 5. I'm coming in very quickly. And we've been able to secure $1.8 million in federal allocations over 2 years to implement workforce development. We've also been able to secure $4.1 million in additional funding in grants that are applicable throughout the program for such thing as prefabrication of bridge components, high-performance steel, rapid reconstruction techniques, and to maintain mobility. I'm getting to summary. ODOT is leaving a lasting legacy through this program, enhancing the quality of life for all Oregonians through this program. It's a transportation solution that reflects on Oregon's values. CSQ helps us preserve Oregon's scenic, aesthetic, historic, and cultural, economic, and environmental values while building safe and enduring projects and structures. A strong state economy and bridges designed to limit impacts on the natural environment. Above all, CSQ means achieving results while preparing for the future, and that sustainable part of the CSQ formula. Through CSQ, ODOT is applying community values to build a generation of bridges for Oregon. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you. I just want to compliment you guys on the job you're doing out at Ontario. The bun coming out there is pretty obvious. You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
And I want to say all this is very impressive, and it's always good to hear good stories.
It is.
And thank you for coming, and keep up the good work,
yes.
Everybody.
Thank you, Chair.
With that, I'm going to close right here.